Welcome to Looks Like New, a show that asks old questions about new technology, brought to you by the Media Economies and Design Lab at CU Boulder. I'm your host, Stephanie Abdallah, and joining me on the program today is Dr. Nesreen Mansour, an assistant professor of architecture at CU Boulder, whose work focuses on the intersection of architecture, spirituality, digital media, and AI. A former research fellow at Princeton Center for Theological Inquiry, she has published widely across disciplines and is now working on the edited book, Religion and AI, Theoretical and Empirical Approaches, that will be published with Bloomsbury next year. Our conversation today will focus on the act of rethinking architecture, especially of sacred spaces, in the age of digital media. We will talk about authorship, agency, and bias in architectural imagination, AI literacy, pedagogy, and the transformative potential of artificial intelligence. Nesreen, welcome to Looks Like New, and thank you for joining us today. We're thrilled to have this conversation with you.
Thank you very much, Stephanie, and thank you for the Mad Lab for this invitation as well.
Of course. Nesreen, I think the best way to start our conversation is by situating our audience on the interdisciplinary nature of the work you do. You are teaching architecture and exploring how sacred spaces take new forms in digital and mediated environments. What first drew you to connect architecture, spirituality, and digital media?
Well, this journey started probably 11 years ago when I first encountered a new term that's called digital religion, which is the practice of religion using digital tools that started in the 1990s when the internet became used by the public, and there was a continuation of these spiritual practices, religious practices from the real life to the cyberspace. So I started learning about this new phenomenon, and I noticed that it was mostly discussing the textual narratives of the religious practices. Not many people have focused on the visual narrative, which is represented through the symbols, the built environment, you know, the spaces that we inhabit when we practice these beliefs. So that's when I decided that I wanted to merge my interest in sacred architecture, since my background is architecture and I was doing a PhD in architecture, with this digital religion phenomenon and study the intersection between architecture, spirituality, and digital media. So, as I told you, this journey started 11 years ago, and since then, I've been seeing a lot of things changing, and today we're seeing the incorporation of artificial intelligence as a new technology, which is not very new, by the way. I mean, we had artificial intelligence since the 50s, but I think it was released more to the general public recently because of the advancement in the, you know, like the hardware also that is available now to everybody. And I call it the big bang of artificial intelligence. Since 2022, there was a big bang of artificial intelligence, which, you know, enabled me to rethink how we design these spaces using a different form of intelligence other than a human one.
Wow, thank you for this introduction. And I'm already so excited to continue this conversation. And I'm really glad you mentioned this turn with AI generative tools, because in fact, this is my next question to you, right? In the last few years, you've been using artificial intelligence's generative tools to reimagine architecture, especially the sacred one, and also to question how technology interprets this meaning, right, that is generated. Can you share how these experiments begun and what they've revealed?
I'm going to tell you a little story of how I became interested in this. So I was in Istanbul in summer of 2022, sitting with a friend of mine who's also a professor in architecture. And I was telling him about, oh, did you hear about all these AI, we call them diffusion models, generative AI, where you take a text and generate an image out of it. I said, did you see that? It's all over the internet and social media. And that's when him and I, we started exploring these tools during that summer. And that was beginning of July of 2022, and I decided that by August, I decided to incorporate that into my design studio that I was teaching. And for the last few years, I've been, like, let's say 4 years or so, I've been teaching. So I'm an I teach architecture design. I focus mostly on transcendence and transcendent design, and, you know, understanding sacredness in architecture, not just in terms of religious architecture, but also everyday architecture. So how can we make transcendence part of our daily life? That's when I decided that I'm going to incorporate artificial intelligence to my students in August of 2022. When I came to the class, nobody knew about this technology. Nobody actually have heard yet about that technology because it was really brand new, right? Mm-hmm. So it was an intriguing question for them, and they wanted to explore it. So we started using the available tool at that time, which is now very advanced in terms of graphic quality, which is called Midjourney AI, which is an image generation tool used a lot by artists and architects and people from the design field in general. Mm-hmm. And that's how my students started imagining spaces, sacredness in spaces using these generative tools. So first of all, of course, they had to understand how to train the tool, how to train the technology, because they're not used to it. They didn't understand where the information was coming from. They had to learn how to write a prompt, which they've never been exposed to. And I don't know if I coined this term or not, which I hope I coined it. I don't know. But I call it in my classroom sketching with words. So you know how in design or in architecture, we start with an idea and then we use the technology like a pen or a pencil and paper, and we start doodling or sketching. We call it sketching these ideas. So what I told my students is to sketch the idea, but then to transform that sketch into a narrative, a textual narrative, using language, using the English language, and to describe that to the AI tool and see what it comes up with. And see, so that's how the students started training their models. And it's interesting that each student had a different way how their model responded to the prompts, which engaged the students into a conversation of, like, how come your model is giving you that and mine is not giving me the same answer? So they started understanding that it's depending also on how, like, each person individually is really interacting with the tool. So that's another form of understanding the intelligence of this tool, like, what are we dealing with? So one of the things, so this is how it began. And I remember one of the first exercises we did is a warm-up exercise where I remember you, I presented that during the class the seminar you were part of, where the students explored this idea of sacred and profane, to define what is sacred and profane using, you know, texts like from Émile Durkheim, ideas of sacred and profane, Mircea Eliade. And you have to remember, these are architecture students, they're design students, so they're not really exposed to, you know, sociologists, French sociologists, or talking about sacredness and profane. So they started defining and redefining until they were able to express their ideas. But one thing, maybe we can talk about it later on, but they came to the realization, and me as well, as a new consumer, a new user of this technology, a realization that it raised questions about ethics, authorship, and meaning of how we use this tool. And emerged from debates that we had after every time we use the tool. We get together in a very democratic form. I like to use a democratic pedagogy in my classes, where we sit together, we discuss, and we collectively make decisions whether we want to continue using it or not. One realization that I still remember until today is that the students felt that only 90% of the work felt that it's theirs. They always felt that 10% was under the control of this technology. So that was, wow, I think, a very interesting realization in 2022, when after 1 week of being exposed to this new technology. Yeah.
Wow, that's very interesting. And I'm really glad you mentioned the ethical aspects of doing this kind of work, because, as you know, and as I presented here at Looks Like New, our main goal is to discuss old questions and how they can be materialized through new technologies, right? And it seems like your work tackles that too. Some of the oldest media and also the oldest architecture in the world are religious. On the other hand, you're discussing these representations using some of the newest technologies that are available to us nowadays. And so what I'm interested in understanding is, what are the old issues about religion and architecture that continue to be reproduced in digital spaces, and then more specifically AI in this case?
Well, I would say, so many of the patterns in what you call old architecture, we call it also vernacular architecture, or classical or classic architecture, there's always this representation, colonial representation, right? And also the very dominance of Western aesthetics, especially in education, I would say around the U.S. and Europe. It's very Eurocentric, very Westernized idea of the history of architecture. So if you go to any, most of architecture schools, when you learn about the history of architecture, you see a lot about Rome and, you know, like Roman architecture and Greek architecture and so on and so forth. So sometimes there's also this risk of the erasure of ethnical or local narratives, which are lacking sometimes in the education or like the pedagogy curricula, architecture curricula. And also the thing that is perpetuated or being represented again is how this whole information and these biases are repackaged now into a form of algorithms. Right. Mm-hmm. So they're repackaged. And so AI is not inventing new problems. It's not inventing really new information. It's amplifying old ones that give us the illusion of innovation. But technically, it's a collage of what's existing that the AI is bringing together, that the machine learning is learning from and bringing together and giving us as a form of innovative form in an innovative form. I like to refer, I don't know if it's a good analogy or not, but I myself found it really interesting to refer or relate this to Bruno Latour iconoclash, because we are either creating or destroying images or meanings. And I will talk a little bit about that maybe later on more in depth. But there is a phenomenon of which I'm noticing more and more is that AI is objectively masking, you know, like deep cultural hierarchies. So it's the databases that it's being trained on, or the data that is being trained on, is more of like archives of modernist architecture, for instance. So if I take architecture specifically, modernist architecture, more like tech-centric, Euro-American design as well. So recently I was working on a competition, an AI competition, to imagine the future of a city, or how to think about a city in the future. And it was interesting because if you put the word future in any AI tool, it will give you this sci-fi idea of the city where cars are flying and like glass buildings, high, tall towers and bridges between them, and it's all shiny, it's all polished, like all the time. So then I had to remove the word future and actually be more specific in terms of like the prompting, because if you put future architecture, future city, that's exactly what you get. And that's a very sci-fi, very Eurocentric idea of how the future was imagined, right? So one thing I would say, and this is what I bring into, or like the new thing that I want to bring into my teaching and my scholarship, is that AI is not neutral. It carries, you know, encoded value systems, and it carries these biases that are part of the data that we're feeding it. And this creates, which I think is a crisis. And it's a crisis of meaning. It's a crisis of knowledge. It's a crisis of commodification of, for instance, like spiritual, what is the symbol of, you know, sacredness, right? And also a very big crisis, ethical crisis, which we, I think we need to start asking question about.
Yeah. Then, and I mean, I feel like this is one of the most pressing conversations we should have around what you're calling this big bang of of AI, right? Because I think there, it comes with this understanding that like other technologies, it's neutral. mm-hmm. when, as you very mm-hmm. well mentioned, it's not. Right? It has mm-hmm. all these embedded biases that we see in other spaces mm-hmm. in our society mm-hmm. just translated into this mm-hmm. Into this digital. And I think it's very interesting that you're mentioning this, because I've had a similar situation with AI, in which I was teaching a class on the myth of the universal around identities, which is pretty much when society grants certain people the status of normativity. For example, while Black people are referred to as Black people, white people are referred to as people, mm-hmm. right? And that's because whiteness is considered the norm. And anyways, the students and I decided, based on this theoretical understanding, that we wanted to test it using AI. And so we asked AI to generate images of a person. Simple as that. That was the prompt, right? And while we could have generated images of any person, it generated, to no one's surprise, mm-hmm. Images of two white people.
Of course.
who were also seemingly able-bodied, mm-hmm. cisgender, and were wearing casual clothes that people would normally wear here in the U.S., mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And I'm sharing this anecdote because it's my personal recognition, too, of the non-neutrality of AI, right? And you've just described some of your experiences with it, but were there some experiences that you noticed happening in classroom with your students, and how did they react to it?
It's funny that you mentioned this example from your class, because so I just came back from an AI convention in Washington, D.C., and it was around, so it's called AI Unlocked, and it was around different topics, you know, how AI is being incorporated in different fields, right? One of them is art, design, politics, engineering, you name it, right? And so they had these different booths during this convention, and one of them was come and create your portrait. You want to have a professional portrait that you can put on your LinkedIn, or like something, you know, another type of portrait. Here, AI can create it for you. So they had this booth with the lines extending until the road, right, with people waiting. And I was standing with these two women of color, one from an Indian descent and another one was an African American. And I was talking to them about these biases, this literal biases of AI. And then it came their turn to take a picture. I didn't want to take a picture, but they wanted to try this AI. And funny enough, when they tried to recreate their portrait, it made them both into white. So basically, they take your picture. So the AI used their picture and you know, they gave it a prompt to create a different version of that portrait. And literally, they took exactly the same picture and put the skin as white. So they didn't even keep the integrity of the picture. So then there was this person who's in charge of this, I guess, this tool, who came running, and he said, no, you have to prompt it and actually say it's for dark skin. So because if you do it without that, AI automatically will think, I mean, we're the bias, or like the default, I would say, the default is going to be the white skin. So we started playing with dark skin, medium skin. We even tried to do ethnicity, you know, like Indian descent, and it still couldn't get it.
Wow.
So, and that was like really interesting to witness with these two strangers that I just met in the expo, and we were just talking about that, and it was just perpetrated there, right in front of us, as a validation of what I was talking about. So, with that being said, I expose my students to these issues. I have a whole lecture. Sometimes this year I think I did it over two sessions. So that's how much I care about you know, like the biases, algorithmic biases, where I also expose them to a writing by Roha Benjamin. They don't know about what's happening, right, from other disciplines. So this is also a good way of bringing interdisciplinarity into the teaching. So and I talk about how in different experimentation, when I myself experimented, you said a person, like you asked your students to generate a person. I prompted my AI, for example, different tools to generate sacred architecture without giving any specification, whether it's an Islamic one or Jewish one or nothing, right? And guess what's the default?
Christian
centric, Eurocentric architecture. So it's usually, you know, Gothic style, Byzantine style, right? So it's very, very European embedded. And I tried it in different languages. So I tried it in English, prompting my AI in English, in French, in Arabic. And it was always the same response. The Arabic one was really funny because I don't think it understood my translation to the Arabic meaning of sacred architecture, mm-hmm. right? So, and then I started probing the AI. You know, like that you start talk. I started talking with the AI, asking like why the default is Christianity and not like. And it started telling me that I have to be more specific. So it was my fault for not specifying what kind of sacred architecture I wanted to see. But then the conversation went on and on about the ethics and about the biases and all between me and AI. And then it acknowledged at the end that it's actually racist and has discriminatory, you know, tendencies towards certain populations and certain cultures because of the data that it's being trained on. And it asked me as a person, as a user, as an educator, because it knows me by now that I am teach architecture, that I need to contribute to how I train the data and the AI to be less discriminatory.
Which on one hand grants you a certain level of autonomy, mm-hmm. right, and agency in this production. But on the other hand, it puts on extra labor onto your body, right? And who are these people who are indeed questioning AI, right? Are the people who I suppose are not seeing themselves represented in these images? So as you mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. people of color, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. So it's again demanding mm-hmm. of these people the extra labor, mm-hmm. the extra labor of doing this training, mm-hmm. right? And that leads me to my next question, because definitely AI bias is a thing, right? It's not about how we are prompting it, right? But if we're considering that there is potential for changing the representations we receive through prompting, mm-hmm. what should we do, right? What's the work that should be put into prompting, and how does that work? Because I know that's something that you teach your students too.
First, I want to talk about AI literacy and how to use AI, right? Because you talked about the consequences of biases in the program, in the data that we're using. The consequences is it a lack of AI literacy, or is it the program biases or like the data biases, or is it both? And I would say both. We are still lacking AI literacy, and also the data is biased, but not everybody is aware of that. Mm-hmm. The people who are, you know, more literate, can we say literate in AI right now, they're starting, or like they're seeing that happening, and it's not new. I mean, Ruha Benjamin have talked about that since 2019, I think, or 18. That was before the Big Bang that we're talking about, right? In AI, one thing I wanna mention here is that the way I use AI, because you asked me how I do that, and it's not just the prompting. So the prompting is only one way, and it's very important to know how to prompt. There's a whole field called prompt engineering, which I feel like I need to, you know, get a degree in prompt engineering to understand how to prompt effectively. But I treat AI in my classes not as a tool, but as a collaborator. It is a tool, but it's a collaborator tool or collaboration tool. Sometimes it is brilliant and it gives us, you know, things that we haven't thought about, but sometimes it is deeply flawed and we notice that and we see that. So we have to learn to listen to what it's telling us about ourselves I think that's also one of the things that I really want my students to start being more critical about using this tool. This is like any technology that we have invented as humans, right? Mm-hmm. We need to be critical of everything that we invent, because to make it efficient of to better humanity rather, you know, than harm it. So first, like the first reaction I have from the students is the first time they come to my class and I say, oh, we're going to use AI in this classroom, is fascination. Of course, I have to mention that I'm going to be using AI in the description of the class before they take it, because also there's this form of resistance that is happening against AI. And a lot of people do not want to deal with the tool at all, or like even hear the word AI, and sometimes it's part of syllabi where it's a whole big paragraph saying you are not allowed to use AI in this classroom. So I put AI in my syllabus. I put a whole paragraph stating that AI is a collaborator. So I already, you know, give the students a heads up that you will be learning about AI, but not learning how to use it just to create these polished, you know, fancy, very striking images that as a person, it would take you probably hours and hours to render, whereas the AI can do it for you in a few seconds. No, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about critical thinking, about questioning the tool and questioning why is it here and how can we use it to our benefit. So the first thing is fascination, as I told you. So the students come and they're fascinating. Yeah, we're going to learn AI. They think it's just like a software that they're going to learn and that I'm going to teach them how to click buttons and create magic, right? But then they started feeling a certain discomfort in the use of the tool, because they start seeing, they start also being concerned. Like I have an amazing group of students this year. So I'm teaching I'm developing a course. I've developed actually as I'm going right now. It's been, what, 2 months, a month and a half that we've been teaching. It's called Architecture, Imagination, and AI, and Artificial Intelligence. And for the first 5 or 6 weeks, we talked mostly about AI ethics. So AI biases, AI copyright issues, where is the data coming from? How is the data being sourced? The environmental issues, the earth extractions to, you know, create even like these computers that we have in front of us right now, they are using lithium batteries that is actually extracted from the earth and harming our environment, right? They have to go through all the system, and that's where the discomfort starts, right? Because they go from fascination about, wow, this magical tool, and then they start knowing the ugly truth and the dark sides of this technology, and that's where they start building awareness, right? So that's why I said it's not just about the prompting, because you asked me about prompting. It's not just The prompting is just one phase, one step. But it's learning everything that comes, like that makes this tool, this technology what it is, in order to understand how to use it. The other thing is also uses a very a critical design process. I think that was one of your questions. So in this critical design process is students. So we use something in AI, like how we use AI, is called workflows. So workflows, you know, like how you're writing an essay. Before you start writing an essay, you write a skeleton or like a layout, and you say introduction, you know, literature review for if we're writing a paper, and then methodology, and then results, discussion, and you know, you have a layout. Mm-hmm. So we create a workflow for AI, which like comes the idea first, then all the information that's going to back your idea, and then how is that narrative going to be translated into that text that you're going to feed to the AI tool, and what are you planning to get out of it, right? Like, what is the outcome? So there's a whole process that the students go through. And I was really, really impressed, and I'm so proud. I want to say I'm proud of my students, because they're so aware now that instead of just going to the AI tool directly and start generating without thinking, you know, like it's a, oh, create, I don't know, like create a space, a school design for me. Or no, they're actually now strategizing and thinking offline, creating this whole workflow and seeing the different possibilities in order to save how many generations they can do, and which in return saves, you know, how many credits, and whether it's monetary because we have to subscribe to these tools, or energy-wise, because every time you type something into the AI tool, you're wasting water, you're wasting electricity that's coming from somebody else's grid. Right, because it's connected to these data centers that are using grids that communities are using, and that's problematic, right? So now the students are strategizing offline before they are sure which one of these workflows they're gonna use finally, and then that's the only one they will use AI for it. So they don't just, you know, experiment for the sake of experimenting.
Right.
And they came up with this on their own.
Wow.
So, I mean, I didn't really teach it that way, but that was the awareness that they reached after 5 weeks of talking about this.
I feel like we all should take your class then. but that's very interesting, you know, that the prompting, as you're mentioning, is just the tip mm-hmm. of that iceberg, mm-hmm. right? And that by understanding mm-hmm. everything that is submersed mm-hmm. in that water, to use the same analogy, mm-hmm. the prompting becomes better,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
Specifically about prompting, how was the process besides this whole understanding of the ethical implications, right, and environmental implications of the work they were doing? How was the process of seeing AI as this collaborator mm-hmm. for your students, and mm-hmm. how did that affect their prompting? Could you give us some mm-hmm. examples of prompts that led to better results because of that?
That's a difficult question because we're still experimenting. It's been, what, like 6 weeks now? But, I mean, in previous years, I didn't have that awareness yet. So when I told you about the 2022, since 2022, 2023, 4, 5, I didn't really have that awareness developed to the point that it is now. Right, because you have to remember something. I was listening to a podcast this morning. I forgot who it was. It was somebody with Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI. They were talking about equity or equality, that all of us are at the same level right now in terms of AI literacy. That we're all exploring. That's what they said.
Are we in the same level, though?
Well, I think in terms of exploration and not knowing the full capabilities, yes, we are. Because that's why you're seeing so many tools. If you are subscribed to newsletters that talk about AI technology, and you receive these emails every day telling you about what's new, it's like you cannot keep up. And that's because we are in the exploration phase. We're still, you know, like trying to advance the tool more and more and more and learn how to use it, because not everybody also knows how to use it. So everybody thinks that, oh, it's just a simple text to generation thing. But that's where you call the prompts. Remember, you're talking to a computer. I'm not talking to Stephanie. You know, like when I talk to you, there's a certain language that we use, certain meanings, even nuances in the topics and the themes that we tackle, right, between us. Even though we speak two different languages and we come from two different cultures, yet we are able, you know, to use the English language that is the common thing between us to express our ideas. But when you're talking to a computer, you're talking to numbers. Right. So an AI is just basically what it's doing is it's based on deep learning, machine learning systems. And it's basically dissecting whatever is existing, you know, like that information. I'm not going to be too technical, but dissecting that and making relationships. So it's a neural network, you know, like making relationships with what you're saying and what's existing out there and bringing it together. So technically, AI is not thinking. It's just bringing things together. Right. That's how I see it. So when people say intelligence, I don't think it is a intelligence the same way we understand you and my intelligence. It's a different type of it. Yes, it processes things much faster than us. because it has, I mean, it was created that way to be, it has faster processing capabilities, but it's not really thinking, it's not aware of or conscious of what it's thinking. And I think consciousness is another topic that a lot of people now are talking about. So I don't want to get into too much, because I feel like I'm going into a rabbit hole right now of, you know, all this information that I have in my head. But when I said earlier that we are equal in terms of AI knowledge, I'm talking about the general public, but mm-hmm. also like people like us in academia, we're still not knowing how to use it. And that's why there's a lack, I think, of regulations, a lack of policies, and I think that's where we should start, you know, like understanding deeper, the technology deeper, and start formulating these regulations. Mm-hmm. I have them in my class. Other professors might have them. Maybe also CU can create some of these policies. We see them in syllabi. But are they standards? They're not standards because the technology is changing every single day.
Right.
So that's why I said prompting is not the only thing. But learning, I think you asked me the questions like, what is the best way to prompt? I think that was your early question. I don't know. To be honest with you, I noticed that the less verbose you are, the better it is, the more specific about things that how you address AI. The better it understands. It's still lacking, and this is from my own experience. I don't know about others, but it's lacking a lot of cultural nuances. So sometimes you have to bring in, and that's where the workflow that I'm talking about comes in. You have to bring in external information to feed it, to help it understand what you want from it. Mm-hmm. So I will bring in my own writings or my own, like my students will bring in addition to the text prompt, they will bring in sketches, they will bring in images that they drew themselves or they made themselves or their own designs and feed it to the model, the AI model, so it understands that this is what actually is working with, mm-hmm. not just out of nothing.
Right.
Yeah.
And... Well, clearly, we are illiterate, right, yeah. when it comes to this.
Yes.
What do you think people struggle with the most? Learning how to use it as a tool mm-hmm. or learning how to think with it?
So I will tell you one thing from my short experience with AI in the last 4 years, which is not actually too short because in the world of AI, that's like a long time, right? The technical side is easy, and that I can tell you. The technical side, it's not the hardest part. The critical side, though, takes time. For example, you can master. I can tell you, like, I can sit with you two now, you know, we're in this room, and I can show you one AI model and tell you, like, okay, this is how it's work. And in a matter of few minutes, you will already start creating your own outputs. Like, that's not an issue, right? But you can spend months though, and learning, the assumptions, your own assumptions, right? So, and that's, I think what I'm trying to do in my class. Of course, we're not going to spend months, trying to unlearn the assumptions, but I'm going to point them out to my students and tell them, okay, this is what AI created. Now, what do you think? And that's how we start critically thinking about the tool. So AI literacy is not just knowing the commands. Again, it's not just knowing the technical parts. I think, again, we can master that in a very fast time and like quickly. But it's learning to question what is in my case in architecture, for instance, what is good design or what does good design look like and how and who defines it. Is it us or the tool or the machine, right? And I think the most in the, well, not I think I can tell you that most of the time the students will respond that it's us because I realized throughout these years that the students will give up on using AI at a certain point because they feel like they don't have the agency that they want over their design and they just completely omit it and put it on the side and just start working on their own with their own, you know, like skills and expertise and other things, right? So I would say fast tech, slow ethics, if I may, and also including, so you said also like using the tool or learning to think with it. I think learning to think with it, but also teaching it how to think with us. Mm-hmm. I don't want to give AI agency over what I want to do. Again, it's just a tool. So we're using it to our benefit. So why would we give it agency to do things on our behalf using our voices, right? So that's, though, I will reformulate what you said, is not learning how to think with it, but teach it how to think with us. Does that make sense?
100%. But how do we do it?
Well, by training it. You know, like by training it, by understanding it first. You have to understand it. Because if you don't understand it, then you don't know how to train it, right? And also another, so I talked about, I think there's one thing we didn't talk about much, and I really want to bring into this conversation, is right now we are using commercial tools that are created for us to be used because these big tech companies, the Silicon Valley. And I will suggest one reading that I've been reading recently. It's a book by Karen Howe. She's a journalist covering AI and actually has been working on open AI since it started in 2015, I think. And she calls the book, it just came out in the summer, it's called The Empire of AI. And she compared actually the Silicon Valley as an empire because it's ruled by like these top, you know, like what, 7-8 people, you know, like the big tech. And they're releasing all these tools for us to use. Right now, they're giving us incentive with starting with free, accounts or like free credit. You don't need to subscribe from the beginning. You just try it, you use it. And then if you like it, then you can subscribe to get more, you know, from it. That's a tactic, mm-hmm. right? That's a tactic because they are actually learning from us because they are learning from how we are using, because without us, they cannot train the data.
Absolutely.
Right? They need us. Let me formulate it. They need us in order to develop this tool. That's why, for example, in my class, yes, of course, I talk about these commercial tools, but I also advocate for the non-commercial tools, and that requires a little bit of technical skill. So if I go back to your question earlier about the technical, like, is it a tool that we should learn? So if you want to use open source AI, for instance, or you want to create your own language model. So instead of a large language model like ChatGPT or Claude, you create a small language model, but you need like some coding skills and also for me, I think copyrights permission from the information or the data that you're using. So if I want to put books in my small language model, I need to ask permission from the authors if I can use their books into my own AI model. That's not commercial. So this is what I'm actually advocating for in my classes, is how we can create our own data to train the AI instead of just relying on the big tech companies to do it for us.
And that's very interesting. And it leads me to wondering about authorship, about agency, because you said it yourself. We are feeding these AI technologies, right? Mm-hmm. And I have personally had the experience of realizing that the more I use AI for a specific topic, even if it's a topic or a term that I have coined, next time I talk to AI about it, it uses the term that I've coined, mm-hmm. Or the approach that I particularly have to that topic as if it weren't mine. Mm-hmm. What does that say about authorship, and how cautious would you say we need to be with how much mm-hmm. we feed AI, how much of our personal creations we mm-hmm. use to feed AI?
Mm-hmm. Well, the example that you gave is related to the memory that AI has. So so here you're talking more about large language model, I assume, right? So textual ones. So those and whatever you feed it, it's going to train itself from it, but not just for you. It's going to also give other people, information that is related to your what you gave it, right? So, for example, if you coined, I told you, I don't know if I coined the word sketching with words. I don't know. I have never asked. I've never checked. I hope I did. I don't know. Like, should I do a patent about it? But now I don't. I wouldn't be surprised if it's used by other people because it was generated by the ChatGPT or whatever that I maybe used it one time or you know to do that. So authorship. So I think. What does that say about authorship? That's a very good question. And I struggle with that. I think every prompt is a worldview. So each one of us has a worldview. And then we're feeding the AI that worldview. And it's being trained on that. So that means it's taking from each worldview and bringing like an amalgam of all these this information and creating new ones right from it. So in a way, it is a political act. Wouldn't you say that?
I would, for sure.
Yeah, I think. And I was a little reluctant, actually, to say that. But I think it is a political act because it's reshaping our world and redefining our future. So I was one of the last conferences I was in. There was a panel about the history. How is AI reshaping history? Right, historical context and historical text and historical data, right? So my question at that time when I was listening, are we actually redefining how history is going to be in the future? I'm struggling, and also tradition. Like I'm currently working on a paper that relates to traditions and vernacular, and I'm rethinking like how is tradition gonna be interpreted in an age where AI, generative AI, and now the worst is coming with the agentic AI, and where we're gonna have agents that run everything for us. Yeah, expected in few. I don't know. Like some people predict in few months, some people predict in 2-3 years. I don't know when it's gonna come. But literally, you have an agent, a virtual, like an intelligent agent that can do anything for you. For instance, I can program it to respond to my emails every day without me checking my email. Like literally.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. So respond to everything that I need in my inbox that day, every day, at a certain time of the day without me even like going through that and providing me with a summary of what I need to know from my emails. That's coming.
Wow. Should we fear that or should
we
embrace it?
No, of course. I mean, that's why I'm talking about AI literacy. That's why I'm talking about asking questions, asking the right questions. So may I jump to something about, like, I want to talk, because you asked me about authorship and ethical authorship is one example that I gave you is to ask permission. You know, like when you use, and that's why there are a lot of lawsuits right now with big tech companies in terms of AI infringing on copyrights. So for example, one example I can tell you how I tell my students to do it. First of all, you ask permission if you're going to use a text or a paper. Let's say, Stephanie, you want to use my paper that you found on, I don't know, Google Scholar or whatever, right? It's okay, maybe send me an email saying, Nasreen, like I really want to use your paper and can I feed it to AI and, because I want to get this information from it. Of course, I mean, it's difficult to do that with everything, right? But maybe we can try little by little to do that. So, for example, for me, I was going to a conference and I had two of my papers that I wanted to summarize into one and, synthesize them to have like 15 slides that I can talk about. So basically, I just took my papers, put them into the notebook LM and I said, give me an outline of how I can synthesize all this information into 15 slides, right? And it only used my papers. So that's the good thing is like it protects that authorship mm-hmm. that we've been talking about, right? Another way, if you're into image generation and all that, like if you go to Google, Google Images, and you search for images, and then there's in tools, there's an option where you can have the copyright use. And there's an option, for example, if you click that it's available for commercial use or for academic use, then actually that means that the author of or like the owner of that image gave you permission to use it in your paper, dissertation, or your research mm-hmm. without having to ask for copyright permissions. So there are ways actually to do that ethically.
How do you think educators can bridge this gap between creative experimentation with AI and this more critical awareness of its ethical and epistemological implications?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously here, what practices have worked best for you and your classes, but also that you have observed in all this research mm-hmm. around AI that you've been doing?
Mm-hmm. As an educator... And it's funny, like I feel like I have this stigma now around me. It's like, oh, she's the AI person. I've been called the AI person since for the last 4 years, and I don't like it because it just feels very negative, right? When it's, oh, she's the AI person. But they're not understanding really sometimes like what it takes to really learn how to work with this tool and how to, you know, benefit from it, because the reason why it was invented in the first time is to make our lives more efficient and like maybe also advance things in, for me, it was more like medicine, I would say, like in the medical field, the health field, you know, advance maybe a cures for cancer or cures for diseases that we couldn't find. So there's some kind of benefit to humanity, right? I feel like I'm torn between, and this is my current research right now, which is I call it the wonder resistance and the in-between, because I feel like there's a binary in how people are perceiving AI. There's a group that is fascinated by it, you know, like they have this wonder and curiosity, and they really want to like they want to know about every new tool that comes out and like what it does, and they're like following, right? And there are those who are completely resistant, and they just don't want to hear anything. Like if you say AI to them, they can even stop talking to you. Because, and I noticed that. I experienced that myself. You know? And they can fight you and tell you, oh, you are unethical. You don't care about the environment. It is true. Like there's this big movement of resistance. Where I situate myself, and I think I encourage educators to situate themselves, is to be in between. So that's why I call it the wonder resistance and the in-between. Because when in the first day of class this semester, this is my AI course, one student came and said, why are you taking this class? And most of them, of course, they're taking the class because they know they want to know more about AI. And also some of them said, because we did internships this summer and our firms asked us if we know how to use AI, and we didn't know. So we felt that we were lacking in our skill set that we're getting from school. So that's why we want to actually have it before we graduate. And I'm teaching graduating class. So basically now they're working on their job applications. So they want to have this in their resume and in portfolio before they apply. And then one of the students said, what is going to be in the future of education, if my 11-year-old sister is now using AI in school? I don't know, 11 year, where are they, like primary, middle school or something like that? If she's using AI right now to help her with her homework, what is going to happen when, like, in 6 years, 7 years, she's going to come to college and then the professors don't know how to teach with AI and don't know how to use AI, right? That was a very good question. I couldn't have an answer for it because I cannot dictate what other people or how other people can, you know. So you asked me about other educators. I can give you my experience from the educational side and maybe suggestions for how educators might, you know, proceed. But I would say AI literacy is very important in education. And whether it's for the students or for us as professors, as faculty, we need to start learning how to incorporate and bring AI into the conversation, whether to be critical or to use it. I think we have to have a balance of usage and criticism. And that's why I talked about the in-between. I think we should be the in-between.
We've talked a lot about bias and limitation, but I'd love to shift gears and think about possibility. From your perspective, what is the transformative potential of AI for reimagining, and this going back to your research, sacred or communal mm-hmm. spaces?
Mm-hmm. So I think AI can help us imagine worlds beyond what we know. And also in terms of this, whether architecture in general, even the spiritual places, that we can imagine more ecological worlds, collective, you know, serving the collective benefits, and also equitable, more fluid, right? So not, rather than just rigid. Of course, that's going to also be subject to a lot of budgets and codes later on. But they can deal with that later when the time comes. But I think its real power is in revealing new ways of thinking, new ways of designing. So when we see what AI produces, we confront what we've normalized as what we call beautiful or divine. And maybe like we can start rethinking about the concept of beauty, which is something I don't like to use in my teaching, like this, the word beauty and beautiful, because it's very subjective, I feel. And it's not something that you can just put a set of standards and say this is considered beautiful if it fits into the standard or otherwise not. Right. But I think that's a beginning of a real transformation. Another thing is that now they are developing something is called, they are thinking about the spatial aspect of AI. So right now it's been mostly flat, but we're moving or we're gearing towards spatial AI because we as human beings, we experience spaces in an immersive format. The AI doesn't do that and it's not comprehending that. So now actually they're doing research on how to make it think of spaces the way we think about them. And I think that's going to be very transformative for architecture and the built environment and the design in general. Also, like to relate it to sacred architecture, I think, as I mentioned, it's a new medium for spiritual speculations, reinterpretations, maybe. Of course, keeping that ethical aspect in mind and like the respect of cultural nuances. What else? Oh, another thing that I wanted to mention is we have, and this is something that I'm starting in the spring of this coming spring. My project is going to be for my students to design data centers. So this is like really, I think it's provocative, and I don't know how students are going to respond to that. But, you know, like how data centers, they are usually boxes with no windows and nothing is going on with them. But then how can we rethink if AI is going to, you know, keep staying here, and now like they're building more and more of these data centers, like how can we rethink actually building these data centers to be ecological ecosystems that are sustainable, that do not harm, you know, the environment or the grid, the energy and the water grid that our people are. On the contrary, that they work together and that actually people can be part of, you know, like that that experience rather than just having them separate entities as if like they were prisons on their own, right? Like these boxes of. And then also it pushes the students to understand how AI itself works in order to design for it. So I don't know. It's an experiment, and I'm starting this in January, and I hope I'll have students registered for my class. I don't know yet, but that's an interesting also way to think about, you know, how to design for it.
This is fascinating. Thank you so much for sharing a little bit of what comes next for you. Before we close, I'd love to ask, what do you hope listeners take away from your work, not just about AI, but about the ways we imagine and inhabit digital worlds?
Mm-hmm. So one, I think there are so many takeaways, but one is AI does not replace creativity. It's actually expanding it. If we know how to stay aware of its ethics and implications of it. I think the future of architecture isn't just about rejecting technology, or not just architecture. If I may say, future of our future is not just about rejecting technology, but it's redefining what kind of intelligence we really want to build into our spaces, whether it's artificial intelligence, or both working together hand in hand. So again, as the staying in between. So I think that's a very important takeaway is let's not try to be in the binaries, you know, like yes or no, but think in between so we can use, but be critical, not be passive consumers, be very critical. So how can we assure a global knowledge and literacy?
Awesome. Thank you so much for these suggestions. I will try to implement those in my personal life. That's a promise. And Nazreen, it's been an absolute pleasure to discuss all of these extremely relevant topics with you. Thank you for your time and for educating us.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for having me, and thank you for giving me the chance to have a voice.
You have been listening to Looks Like New on KGNU's It's the Economy. Looks Like New is a show that asks all the questions about new technology, coming to you from the Media Economies Design Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder, and is produced by Alexander Lipka. You can find us on the fourth Thursday of every month on air or online at lookslikenew.net or wherever you get your podcasts. We hope you'll join us next month. Thank you for listening.